This is the local government of the future subcommittee meeting of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. It's Tuesday, September 28th. And this is the agenda for today is really a continual discussion of the role of home rule in establishing policy in the state of Connecticut, which can oftentimes be moved and shaped and configured around what people think it should be as opposed to what it actually is. So we had decided to break up our individual monthly subcommittee meetings and dedicate them to individual topics within that realm. Previously we had some discussion about the role of home rule on municipal finance. Today we were going to talk a little bit about the role of home rule and its impact on positive and negative on education, and how some misperceptions of home rule can actually distort a little bit about a little bit of how we do education here in the state of Connecticut. Sticking with our agenda, just reminding folks that this is a recorded meeting and it is a public meeting. So, you know, the rules on Zoom, if you'd like to be recognized to speak, either raise your hand or use the raise hand function and announce yourself so that you can be recorded and recognized. This is not a formal meeting where we normally have minutes taken, but Bruce is good enough to take notes from our meetings to keep us on track. To that point, on item two of our agenda, we do have a draft that Bruce has provided to us of the meeting notes from last month's meeting. I don't know if anyone had any comments or thoughts on those notes. Or corrections. If not, I think we'll go right to our topic for discussion today, which is, again, how the application of home rule impacts education at the local and regional level. I would also just add for those on the call, after Lon provides us with his presentation, I think we are going to have a follow-up discussion about that kind of falls along the lines of what Jim's comments have been over previous meetings. We've had some internal discussion about the effectiveness of breaking and dedicating each of our subcommittee meetings each month to this home rule topic, and perhaps maybe reconfigure it a little bit. And dedicating these meetings perhaps to other topics, but doing the work of that we had contemplated for the next few months internally, and maybe dedicating this meeting time to some other topics that are certainly relevant for us, particularly as we're looking ahead to the 2022 session. But so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, Lon, if you could. You were good enough to sort of take this on, and if you don't mind taking over the reins, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not going to do any PowerPoints. I think I'll just kind of talk for a little bit, maybe 10 minutes or so, and then we can just have a conversation. I'm going to put a link in the chat for a page on CABE, and this is the link that I send to people that are interested in running for the Board of Ed, because I think it really kind of gives a good summary as to where you fit in the whole structure of government. So I've been on my local Board of Ed, at least this one, since 2003. So I'm on year 18. So I was like 12 when I started. And I was first elected actually to a Board of Ed in 1999. I was on the Westbrook Board of Ed for a couple of years before I moved to Essex. And about 8 months ago, I was appointed to a second Board of Ed. So I'm on now my local Board of Ed in Essex, where I'm the chairman. And I'm now on the Region 4 Board of Education as a regular member. And I am up for re-election on both. I got cross endorsed, so I'm locked in for a long time.
Lon, if I can just interrupt you. So yep. You started on Board of Ed before you met your wife?
Actually, yes. Well, my wife and I went to high school together. But we were not dating when I first got elected in 99. That's correct. In fact, we had lost touch. And it wasn't until the following year that I even called her up for coffee. So
I'm only saying that because I came to the legislature in 01 and so.
That's right. Yep. My wife was working there at the time.
Yeah, so. The time.
Yep. It goes, time flies. It's kind of crazy. So I've been on for a while. It's when you're on for as long as I've been, you begin to figure out where the lines are, because oftentimes you cross one and you get told you're doing the wrong thing. So I think I can probably give you some ideas to where this goes on or where we fit in. It's an interesting position in the governance structure of our state, because there's a lot of local control. However, all of our authority comes from the state. In fact, when you look at that CABE guideline, it kind of refers to us as an agent of the state government. And our role is to ensure that state mandates and state regulations and state law are being applied appropriately within our school district. So that's kind of our charge as board members. Even though we have a lot of authority to make decisions within that framework, that authority comes from the state. And our role really is to ensure that we are doing what the state tells us to do. That said, we have quite a free rein as to how we comply with those mandates and laws within reason. You have less free rein when it comes to special education, because that's a federal mandate and there's other things that come through that process, and I can touch on that. But largely, the state doesn't tell us how to teach. They sort of tell us what to teach, but it's up to us to develop the curriculum that fits best within our school system. We pick the textbooks, for example. The state is not telling you which textbook to buy. And I know that over the years, we've spent a lot of time kind of trialing different curriculum or curricula to figure out what works best for our district and our teachers and what the state is requiring from us. And, on the curriculum side, the big measurement tool, which I'm not a big fan of, is that we have those mastery tests that kind of shut us down for a week as all the kids take them. And then when those tests are completed, the state gets a picture as to how we're performing, making sure that those curriculum guidelines are being followed and we're meeting standards across the board. My personal opinion is I would love to see, a more localized approach to that, where the state and the district agree upon a set of measurement tools and we can better measure students throughout the year, which many districts do, as opposed to just having a snapshot. And as some of our schools get smaller, if a kid has to go to the bathroom, it often blows up your entire test score. So there's definitely some, I think, room for improvement and maybe some room for a little more local control in so far as how we measure things. We do, though, I think this whole COVID experience has been an interesting one, because if you look across the board, and I was just on a call yesterday about distance learning, remote learning, every district kind of approached the COVID response differently. We certainly have some guidelines that we have to follow vis-a-vis masking and social distancing and whatever, but a lot of the internal practices as to how we operate were largely determined by the boards of ed and sometimes in conjunction with their public health department. And so the result, I think, over the last year, with some schools being fully in, some being hybrid, some that were hybrid were not delivering the remote education in the same way, because every district had to negotiate a separate MOU with their local bargaining units to figure out how instruction would be delivered. So, I think there's still, a lot of leeway for local districts to make decisions that work best for the communities that they're serving. A couple of other things of interest related to the Board of Ed is the finances. I know Speaker Sharkey and I were working a lot on the minimum budget requirement, the MBR. So that's an example of a state mandate where my Board of Ed cannot spend less than it did the year before. And there's a good reason, which I learned, which I wasn't aware of at the time that we were trying to get that law amended, but there's a good reason that exists, is to prevent local municipalities from short funding their schools, especially in areas where there's schools of high need. We also are responsible, personally responsible, for the finances of the school. So if there's some huge financial issue that arises that results in taxpayers losing money, the board members personally are on the hook. And that's, I don't know if that's true of any other elected office in the state, but there's a personal liability. And that goes back a very long way. Knock on wood, I don't think it's ever happened anywhere. In many cases, your local school district kind of indemnifies you from personal liability. But nonetheless, you know, you will see court cases from time to time where somebody sues the school district, but also the board members individually, because the board members do have some personal culpability or responsibility for the finances and operation of the school district. Additionally, with finances, the Board of Ed is solely responsible and solely has the authority to determine how its money is spent. So we put a budget together in my town. Now we're a statute town. We put a budget together. We put it before our Board of Finance. The Board of Finance can approve the final number, but they can't tell me how to spend those dollars. So they couldn't tell me cut a teacher from fifth grade. They could cut an amount of money commensurate with what a teacher might cost. But if I decide that, or my board decides that that teacher is important, we could keep that particular position. Every town and city does it differently. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that there's a tremendous amount of leeway in how a local municipality actually constructs its Board of Education. So for example, in my town, the local Board of Education for Essex is 6 members. The neighboring towns have 9 members each on their boards, and they have different term lengths. And some cities, the mayor appoints a certain number of Board of Education members. Other cities, the mayor appoints everybody. So, you know, there's a lot of local flexibility in how you constitute your Board of Education. And if you're a charter town, you have even more authority to put that together. The Board of Education structurally only has its authority when it meets as a Board of Education. So I can run around town talking to people about anything, obviously, but I can't represent the board even as its chairperson on a matter of importance unless my board is actually sitting in a meeting making those decisions together. So the board has to be in session for it to have the authority. If the board needs to do something, then it has to call a meeting so that it has the authority to do it. I think that's probably true of many other municipal offices. Like, you couldn't have a zoning committee deciding something over the phone. It's kind of a similar scenario, but it's something that we often train new board members on, to be very careful about what their behavior is in the public outside of a meeting. You can't represent the board's position outside of a meeting. And you know, from a standpoint of being a good, you know, responsible member, if the board votes as a majority to do something, you don't have to agree with the decision, but you have to, you know, kind of be supportive, or at least not try to make it worse for the board if you were on the losing end of a vote. The board only has one employee. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, over the years, I get calls from parents and, you know, looking for the board to do something in relation to how a staff member is operating or whatever. And the board, you know, really doesn't have the authority to kind of micromanage the district. The board's role is to manage the superintendent of schools, who then manages the district. So oftentimes, you know, I would ask a parent who calls me, have you talked to the principal yet? Let's work our way through this process. If they get through the principal and they get to the superintendent and they're still not satisfied, that's when the board steps in, talks with the superintendent, and tries to get, you know, a resolution to the issue for that particular problem. The interesting thing too is that of all of the school employees, the evaluation of the superintendent is the only FOIable employment document that can be retrieved. I'm sure there's some exceptions based on certain circumstances or whatever for other employees, but generally the superintendent who works for the board is almost a public figure in of themselves, in that they don't have the kinds of protections that their employees might from public document release. So when we have a whole, you know, policy in regards to how we evaluate the superintendent. I have a call next week to revise that for this year, just because we have a very complicated school district where I live. And that's kind of the way things roll. Now, every Board of Education has a very big set of policies. When I first got on the board, it was in a binder. Now it's online. And those policies are sometimes locally generated, you know, so we have, for example, a cell phone policy about using phones in school. And that's specific to our particular environment. But we have other policies that we have to revise and add to the school policy manual that are required by law for us to be in compliance with state law. So it's kind of a mixture of making policies that you really don't have much of a say on, but you have to vote on to put into your policy manual because the state says so, versus others that we have the authority because the state hasn't taken that authority from us to put in locally. And that includes curriculum and textbook decisions and all that kind of stuff. The challenge sometimes is that there's, when we say the state, you know, we have a lot of different vectors by which the state can assert authority or take authority from a local board. One way is through the State Board of Education and the Department of Education setting curriculum standards, for example. So the I think most recently the science curriculum was adjusted. We had to, you know, redo our curriculum to match the state standards. And those are the kinds of things that you have time to prepare for, because the state will communicate out to districts, hey, we're going to be looking at science. We'd love to get your input. There's usually a process involved with it. And the legislature is not doing any of that. It's all within the bureaucracy, but there is a appointed board from who's appointed by the elected leadership who signs off and makes that the regulatory law of the land. But the legislature also has the ability to do things. And so there's no restriction for a legislator to walk in one day and say, you know what, there ought to be a law that says you have to teach X, Y, or Z in school. And what happens is sometimes, you know, these things will be things that nobody will ever want to vote against because it sounds good. But when you require something be taught in school, it goes outside of that structure in which the State Board of Ed and the department, put curriculum together. So a lot of times, you know, you'll have a law passed in May or June. And you're scrambling to get that class ready for the following semester. And there's only so much time in the day. I think what scares us as board members the most is that there's a lot of different ways these things can come at us. Cabe has Sheila McKay. I don't know if she's on the call today, but Sheila and Patrice usually are. Yeah, I see you're on the list there. I like to say that they're usually out there, you know, kind of alerting us to the asteroids that are coming our way, because really anybody in the legislature can put a bill together that could significantly disrupt the flow of how we do things. And I think a great example is one that we talked about in ACIR related to the school bullying policies that many schools have had before a law was passed. So in that instance, I know in my district, we had a set of processes, we had policy, we had internal procedural documents to how we go about dealing with school bullying. However, the legislature was lobbied to change that and create a harmonized process that every school district has to follow that includes training every single school employee on what to look for and how to file these reports. And you know, it got to the point where it was a real issue for our professional development. We only have so much time to train teachers before the beginning of the year. And now we're training everybody from the bus driver to the cafeteria workers to the crossing guards on, you know, looking for signs of bullying and, you know, kind of making them a local mandated reporter when they see this. And these are the things that you have to do. And even though we already had all this, that authority to create that bullying policy ourselves was taken away by the legislature and then replaced with a state policy that we now have to follow. And I think one of and I'll just leave it on at this point. I think one of the biggest frustrations that I've had over the years is that I see a lot of innovative practices going on within local school districts because they have the authority to try things and experiment with different ways of providing curriculum to students and developing policies for dealing with bullying, for example. And I think there's a real push, a real notion somehow that the more we can have from a larger governmental body kind of determining these things, the better it's going to be. But I think we're ignoring that there's a lot of potential and a lot of innovation happening within these school districts, partly because we have so many. And sometimes people say that's a bad thing, but I think it's actually a good thing because you have a lot of different districts that can try a lot of different things. And the good practices, I think, can kind of go upstream that might actually save taxpayers money and make things better for kids. So, you know, my whole philosophy on being a local Board of Education member is that, you know, we should be looking for more local and state partnerships before we start passing laws and mandating things, because a lot of times the practices are in place in many districts that actually work. And I think there's a lot of capacity that goes unused between districts that could work better. The last point related to that is that the way our school districts are structured is that the state constitution says that every town has to have a school district. And that has changed over the years because some towns can opt to join a regional school district. But that requirement and the way it's interpreted creates these barriers that make it very difficult to share things between districts. And I've talked a lot about in the past about the local education agency, the LEA, and how the interpretation of what an LEA is in Connecticut makes it really hard for school districts to collaborate and work together and maybe even share programming. Because I can't always, even within my three-town regional district, we can't always have a student from one town go to school in another, even though we have the same superintendent running everything and even though it's the same staff members. And that's because of how Connecticut defines its LEA, and that's how Connecticut plugs into the federal structure. And the definition of what a local school district is entirely on the state. And so when the state says you can't share this resource because of federal law, it's because we have defined the school district so narrowly, as opposed to allowing school districts to maybe create larger ones amongst themselves that doesn't necessarily follow the regional guideline that is the only way to do it at the moment. So it's, you know, it's an interesting area, but I think really it's one of the most rewarding things that I do in my life. I really enjoy serving the community. It's great to see the kids. I've been on the board so long now, I've had kids that weren't even born yet now graduating from school. So it's fun to watch those kids grow. We have them come to our board meetings. I've got now two of my own in the school system. So it's fun to see how, you know, how important our schools are to our communities. And nothing has been more evident of that than COVID times, because, you know, our communities, just the overall vibe in town, if you will, just got so much better and more hopeful when the kids were able to get back into school. And that was something that we had to do in partnership with public health, where we plugged into an area of government we hadn't really before. But it's, I think it's very, you know, a unique way of managing education. And I think the fact that Connecticut schools are so high performing compared to the rest of the country is probably evident of how we have so much local accountability to how our schools operate. And I think that's one of the real strengths of what we do, even if it doesn't look like having a million school districts is a good thing. And hopefully that makes sense. And
yeah. Well, so yeah, thanks for that. So I guess the, you know, in the context of how ACIR has been approaching this in terms of the understanding of the of the limits or not of home rule on it, it, you know, one of the things that you're pointing out is that, unlike maybe on the municipal side, boards of education actually have an awful lot of autonomy to develop or manage. They have a lot of home rule, right? I mean, they do have the, and as opposed to maybe municipalities, which don't have as much. And so, you know, I was interested in your thought on something that hit Guilford over the summer, my new hometown, in terms of critical race theory and the extent to which local parents got themselves very worked up over a perceived education policy adopted by the Board of Ed here that they perceived was happening here in Guilford. And, you know, the groundswell, and I'll, for those of you who have not been following this, there was a huge uproar in several public meetings throughout the summer about people being upset that critical race theory was being taught in our schools. And it was pointed out that that was actually not the case, that it was not part of a curriculum and not part of a, you know, of an overall plan adopted in the curriculum. But nevertheless, it became a flashpoint to the point that, politically speaking, a group of citizens, Republicans, basically took over. And, you know, they organized after all the conventions had taken place and the candidates were endorsed, they did have time to put together a challenge slate to primary all the Republicans who had been nominated, and they won overwhelmingly on the Republican side. I'll just parenthetically, I'll mention that the Republicans in town were not happy, obviously. This is sort of an upstart grassroots effort, but and also the way the Democrats structured their slate. It's Democrats and unaffiliateds who count as minority for minority slots. So it's very likely that even though this group of Republicans who had organized won their primaries, their Republican primaries, none of them may actually make it to the Board of Ed because it's a very Democratic town and there's also the minority slots that will be filled by unaffiliates. But that was an example, I think, of it, you know, and raised questions about the ability of the local Board of Education to adopt a critical race theory in theory, to enable them to adopt that as part of their curriculum, which then led local folks to object and raise objections to it. So, in that sense, home rule. Yeah, I mean, in our current structure, home rule would allow the local Board of Education to incorporate CRT into a curriculum locally, right?
There's no, right, and I think this is what comes down to how the state authority plugs in. And I've had, you know, I've obviously talked to a lot of people about this in my community as well. And I've assured people that ultimately any curriculum decisions at the moment related to that would be something the local board would be responsible for, you know, for doing. Now, the state could say, we want this curriculum taught in the schools, at which point we would all have to comply with that. For example, there was a bill passed this past session for, I believe, a Black and Latino studies elective be offered in every school system. So, and that was a legislative mandate that now is a state mandate. And school districts have some guidance as to how to build that curriculum. However, ultimately, again, we have authority to determine exactly how that curriculum is administered within the district itself. We are in the process of having discussions in our district, I think, just to make sure everyone understands what we're doing. Because one of the things that I've said as a board member for a long time, and my first month as chairman, we had a little issue erupt here related to preschool being moved to our building. And, you know, I had a room full of people showing up at my Board of Ed meeting upset. And I learned my lesson at that point, which is that if you have people showing up to your meeting angry, you know, you missed something. You should be out in the community talking to people and trying to figure out where people are at. And it's been really interesting because I've been really eager whenever somebody contacts me with a concern, you know, either sit down with them in person or have a Zoom call these days or whatever they're comfortable with, just to try to figure out where it's at. Cause I want people to know that, you know, I'm going to listen and hear what they have to say. And I don't want, you know, I want to model behavior on our Board of Ed that our kids can see as good execution of civics. And that's not always achievable. I mean, I think things can, you know, get squirrely sometimes, but yeah, I mean, in the case of the CRT example now, you know, every district can determine how they direct their curriculum. And, you know, I think citizens have a right to express concern to their local boards, and the boards should be, you know, being able to effectively communicate. And I'm not criticizing the Guilford board here, but, you know, I think that's part of the role is that. And, you know, what happens too, a lot of times, you know, you can go a couple of years without anything really big happening. And my concern is when I don't have people at my meeting at all, you know, what am I not hearing? So, you know, I try to stay on top of it, but, you know, no one's perfect. And I'm sure
but in terms of the, you know, if we think about how many folks may misappropriate the term home rule, mm-hmm. I think what the CRT example demonstrates is that actually, unlike on the municipal side, there is a lot of home rule. You know, that state statutes create, obviously, mandates and structure. But if a local resident has a belief that when it comes to education, that their local school district needs to do this or not do that. And we can do that because we have home rule. Mm-hmm. That's actually not an inaccurate statement.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I sometimes when you're in this business, and as you know, working in politics, there's, you know, some people just dismiss what the other side has to say. And sometimes you'll hear some really crazy arguments from people, but a lot of times there's an aura of truth to their concern. And, you know, I think in the case of local curriculum, the local boards of education, again, have to meet those state requirements, but the curriculum is largely determined locally. And I think it's caught a lot of boards off guard because the curriculum largely hasn't been controversial until now, where it's becoming more controversial. I mean, we had some controversies when I first got on the board here in Essex 18 years ago about how our math curriculum was being rolled out. You know, that was certainly developing a lot of concern, and we had to adjust for that. We hired new staff to fix the curriculum that wasn't being rolled out properly. And so we have a lot of responsibility, you know, when it comes to curriculum, and a lot of control over that. Another example is the masking. So right now, you know, the governor's mandate, which is a state mandate, it's got the force of law right now, is requiring us to have masks on inside of the building. However, we do not have the authority, as far as I know, to require masking on school grounds outside of the building. You know, so we had some parents concerned that there was a lack of distancing sometimes at school pickup and drop off, and we had to remind parents, you know, to distance themselves, you know, just be courteous to others. But we don't really have an authority to go beyond the interior of the building right now with masking and distancing and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, I think what'll be interesting to see after February, and I've kind of told my board members this, you know, I said, if we see vaccines being available for young children, it's very likely that we're going to have to make some decisions about the health practices within our building, which have largely been out of our control. Because there is no state law that dictates children have to wear masks inside of a building. They do have to wear clothing, but that's because there's laws about indecency that cover that, right? So, you know, there's some degree of authority there that we will have in regards to that. You know, school districts can set separate dress codes, for example, right? You know, they can deem certain clothing not to be suitable for school. And so some schools have uniforms, and that's all within the purview of the school board to decide locally. So that's
another. And for example, if in a particular town, if the local residents, let's again get back to the masking example, you know, if local residents said, look, you know, we are opposed to masking in schools. We have an executive order that requires it. Once that expires, you know, and local residents say, look, we have home rule. We operate under a home rule principle, so we can adopt whatever policy we want. As long as the state doesn't prohibit it, we can adopt whatever policy we want. So henceforth, either we want masks all the time or we don't want masks ever. I mean, that actually is within the purview of local boards. Absent an executive order.
Right. And, you know, we've had some issues like, it's interesting because before the pandemic, we actually had in my tenure on the board about, I think, two or three instances where public health did direct us as a board to do something. And some of these weren't necessarily a board decision. The superintendent could make the call. We had a MRSA bacteria outbreak in one of the schools a number of years ago. And so that prompted the superintendent to close the building and do. This is where deep cleaning actually makes a difference on MRSA, cleaned the whole building top to bottom and then brought the kids back in after it was clean. So we had that. We had the West Nile thing right before the pandemic hit, where we were having games earlier in the evening to prevent, you know, mosquito bites. So, you know, those are the sorts of things that, you know, sometimes public health will direct us to do something. But where the reason why I think there's been so much concern over the governor's emergency powers is related to that masking thing, because short of those requirements from the state, it is a local decision. So what would happen in the case of the expiration, let's say it didn't pass yesterday. we would have locally had to make the call. And what I've been doing in preparation for that, the state has some really great data tools now. So I've been tracking a spreadsheet of natural infection in town. I've been looking at vaccination rates across different age groups, because at some point we're going to have to make that decision. I believe it will be a local decision once the numbers statewide are low enough. And, you know, I want to be able to come to the community to say, you know, here's what we've experienced, here's what we know, here's what our numbers are looking like, and here's why we're making that decision. So I think local board members are being placed in a, you know, especially related to CRT and pandemic response, you know, areas that I think have become more nationally volatile, perhaps, than what we've typically experienced, which has largely been very locally focused. You know, every big issue that we've had in my tenure on these boards of ed has always involved some local decision that we made or some, you know, staffing issue. But, you know, it's a new experience, I think, for kind of the larger outside world being affecting so many different boards at the same time. And, you know, I think you have to really, you know, prepare for those things and also make decisions based on your data and not how you feel. And I know legislators, you know, have experience for that. You kind of sign up for getting knocked around quite a bit. A lot of us local board members, you know, aren't ready for that. But we do have those authorities under state law.
And last thing, you said it at the very beginning. The fact that boards of ed are actually agents of the state statutorily, that actually maybe explains why so much autonomy, why so much home rule. Is that correct? I mean, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but maybe that's actually the reason why.
Yeah, I think you know,
that level of autonomy, because actually they function as an agent of the state.
Yeah, you know, Lyle had put had given us a good history lesson on kind of New England governance, and I forgot the term that he used, but it's, you know, it's permissive power, I guess, is kind of the way it works, in that anything we don't tell you you can't do, you can do. And so, you know, I think that's the approach that we've largely taken here. Now, I've worked with a lot of superintendents in my district over the last 18 years, and each of them brings a different approach to education and how they manage the school district. But, you know, by and large, you know, we've never felt, you know, with the exception of some of the issues that I deal with related to regional cooperation amongst our towns, you know, in the things that we're restricted from, insofar as that, within the LEA that you're responsible for, you do have a lot of autonomy, until you don't. And, you know, it can be, you know, taken away from you in a heartbeat. You know, the state could decide tomorrow to the legislature could pass a law that says whenever there's a flu case in school, every kid has to put a mask on, and that would become the law, and we would have to comply with that. You know, so it you know, you have the authority again until you don't. But I think, though, what we lose sight of in Connecticut is that, you know, you think about, oh my gosh, we have 100 and something school districts, everybody's like doing their own thing, it's kind of insanity, but look at the outcome. The kids are, you know, nationally, we're top tier, you know, across the board. And certainly there's no school district that's perfect. I think you have a board of ed because the school district isn't perfect. And that's why you have 6 or 9 or however many members you need to ensure that problems get resolved. But I think there's a lot of innovation happening locally. And I don't see a mechanism, and we're trying at CABE and we're trying in other areas, but there's no, like, I think, a state mechanism for looking at all of these amazing things that have happened because these local school districts have the ability to think outside the box and make decisions for, you know, for their district. I think it's helped us be more accountable. When you don't have a big county school board, you know, if I'm at the grocery store, you know, I got to plan ahead because I know I'm going to run into people that have something to tell me. And so, you know, that local accountability keeps me on my toes. You know, I have that personal financial responsibility, which always makes me, you know, very careful about looking at the books every month too. And I think there's some real benefit to smaller units, especially when we're measuring outcome on a student by student basis. You know, our charge under No Child Left Behind, a federal mandate, which was put down through the state and became state requirements that we have to follow as their agent, says no child can be left behind. So we need that direct, you know, one-to-one attention on the students. And I think one of the great things about our state is that because there's so much local accountability, because you have that local board of education, you know, you've got a real close eye on things and a real partnership between the lay people, me, and the professionals, the superintendent and the school system, to make sure the outcomes are good and that your community is involved in the decisions that that district makes. And that's why I always feel like if I got people showing up in my meeting, it's happened to me from time to time. I feel like I'm not serving as well as I could be if I'm not hearing what people have to say before they show up to my meeting angry. And I'm never going to be perfect. I'm sure I'm going to have people showing up angry for something over time. But, you know, I think that's the real benefit to our structure here.
Right.
And it's unique, I think.
Yeah. Margaret?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I was jumping up and looking at something because there was a quote in the NAWQ Hour report on the House's session yesterday that said that Craig Fischbein, who whatever is on the Judiciary Committee, said there was not a date to end these requirements in the actual bill. You could be wrong, but maybe that would solve your problem about, you know, whether it's going to continue or not. It's just sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know what the bill said or not. You know, I just know what we end up getting told to do. But, you know, I brought this up in one of our ICR meetings a few weeks ago. I guess it got in the paper afterward also because it showed up on an article. But, you know, as a board member, you know, look, you signed up to make decisions. And my thing has been throughout this is like, we're ready to make the decision. Just tell us whose decision it is to make. And I think that's where we get nervous because we don't know if we're going to get, you know, dealt with this at the last minute. You know, we had, you know, when schools reopened, you know, the timeline was pretty compressed. Because some of the things coming from the Department of Ed and the public health were not getting to us quickly. So we had impact negotiations to have with our teachers and we didn't know what we were going to be required to do or not. So, you know, those are some of the things where that breakdown of who's in charge of what sometimes becomes a little bit more challenging.
Thank you.
Rick, sure.
Hey, Lon, thanks for all of that. It's really, really interesting. I actually have two different kinds of questions, and I don't know, I may be overthinking this, but one has to do, and I'll do the second question. I'll save the second question for the thing that I think is most relevant for us today. But there seems like in some states across the country, a disinvestment or a movement away from commitment to public education. I don't think that's true in Connecticut so far. But when we talk about these issues at a high level, are there things we should be thinking about for the longer term which can prevent a movement away from commitment to and confidence in public education? That's the first question. And the second one, I think, is more relevant to this. If you describe the relationship between state government and local boards of ed, but if the state decided that it was in the best interest of the state as a whole and its population as a whole to do more to soften borders between local districts, how would that play out in the context of this discussion about local control or home rule? So two different issues, but appreciate your thoughts.
I think they're related because, you know, one of the things that I found locally here is that the townspeople are often most comfortable when they have to make a big decision about spending money, maybe for a building or something like that, or some kind of regional cooperation thing or something. I found over the years in just talking to people about what we're proposing, what we're thinking about, that by and large, the community tends to gravitate towards things that we define locally as opposed to things that get defined for us by the state, vis-a-vis regionalizing our school system. Regionalization is a state statute. The state tells you how to do everything. Not everybody's crazy about what that's meant for our towns over the last 70 years. And so when I propose that and propose another idea where we're going to create an agreement between us to operate our schools in a similar fashion, but there's going to be a greater deal of local input and control. People tend to like that idea better. And I think that comes back to the local accountability and ensuring that people have a voice and a role in the school system. You know, I'm not going to say that we're perfect where we are here. I mean, no district is, but, you know, I've had a lot of frank discussions with people about the issues we've talked about today related to public health. And I mean, I always agree, but I'm not offended when somebody has another opinion. And I think, you know, the more that local boards can do to hear people out, even if it's, you know, sometimes some people cannot make their points in a way that I think lifts the dialogue to a point where it needs to be. But I've had many discussions with people who are very thoughtful about CRT and their concerns about it and concerns about masking. And sometimes we leave it of where, you know what, we're not on the same page here, but they don't feel like there's that someone's trying to change the way their child thinks, for example. So I think the big effort that we have to make as our society gets more diverse and our schools actually are getting diverse faster than greater society is right now, is to ensure that everyone feels that they have a place in a public school. And I think in many of our smaller districts, I think there is, you know, a good feeling that everyone is there to learn from each other and to be there as part of a school system that, you know, represents what the community wants to become. And it requires leadership. Requires leadership on the part of the administrators, but also board members. And I think we board members are getting into, you know, an area of leadership that we may not have had to be in before. But I think it's important to maintain that confidence to let people know when they get to school that, you know, I actually think a comment that was made at one of our CAVE meetings from our executive director said no one should be ashamed of who they are. Period. And I think that's you know, that's kind of the approach that educators have to look at is how do we make sure that public education is public? And I've always found it to be the great equalizer. I went to school with, you know, with refugees when I was growing up in my small town. And, you know, they came to school not speaking English and became part of the fabric of the community. And so there's a lot of good things that come out of that. And I think we just have to, you know, approach things carefully, thoughtfully, and involve everybody's decision because it is a public asset and it's a public point of pride in my town. So it's not easy, but you know, I think it's a definite concern. And you know, I think too, when you look at other states, when the state has greater control over education, the dollars become, you know, they become larger. You see a real difference in what happens locally there because the local town doesn't have that authority. And within our towns, you know, every year, every school budget, for the most part, goes up. And in most towns where they vote as a community to decide whether or not to make that budget what it is, the towns generally support it because I think they have faith in the local leadership.
Thanks, Rick. Are any other questions for Lon or comments? Okay. Good. Well, thank you, Lon. I think what we're going to try to do is include this in the compendium that we're trying to put together as a body for discussion with the legislature. I should say that at our last meeting, full meeting of OCIR, for those of you who were not there, we were joined by Senator Cassano, who suggested that actually the outcome of this discussion should really be presented to legislators sooner than later. That our thought initially was let's put together a package of findings based upon what these meetings and discussions produce, and then present it to legislators in early 2022 in anticipation of the next session so that everybody can be operating with the same understanding of what home rule really means. And Steve's attitude was, no, let's not wait until 22 to do that. Let's try to put something together sooner than later. And open it up for discussion and comment from D's and R's and both on the Planning and Development Committee, but also elsewhere.
No, and I'm sorry, just to pipe in, I think related to that too, you know, what you just heard was an experience of a board member in a small community. And so, you know, I almost wonder if it might be helpful to have, we could help find some folks who are board members in larger communities in some of our cities, because, you know, the control structures are different. The districts are bigger. There's more middle management that they have in the course of things. And I think that might be interesting to hear from, you know, from the perspective of an urban school board member about what their experience is like versus mine.
Right.
And I almost wonder too, if it might be helpful for the legislature, maybe to hear from some board of ed members, maybe a panel that's representative of different size boards, about what it's like to be us. We're kind of on the receiving end of everything. So, you know, so I think that might be a useful discussion too, just to even have a panel where we can all just talk and better understand the outcomes of each other's decisions.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. That kind of, I think, leads nicely into, as a segue into the other topic that I think we want to, I know our agenda just talked about generally the, thanks, Deborah. Yeah, I'm seeing your point about, identifying urban and suburban and rural district members who may be able to contribute to that. I know that we have Steve Mendick's summary of what Hub Rule means and the statutory and legal context. And we talked about the financial side and now the Board of Ed side. We've had some internal conversations among the leadership of ACIR just in the last few weeks, along the lines of some comment that Jim had offered at our last subcommittee meeting, which is maybe should we be thinking about, and I also think practically speaking, we are dedicating a lot of time in our subcommittee context of local government of the future to this topic, and that maybe we could also be rededicating that time, that subcommittee time, to other topics relevant to the local government of the future, as opposed to dedicating entirely to this home rule discussion. I think between Martin and Lyle and John Felchak, who I think initiated this concept with the group, I think there was, and of course, added Bruce into the discussion as well. I think there was an inclination perhaps to not continue on, particularly then when Steve Cassano offered up, let's get in front of legislators before, we spend the next few 3-4 months on this. Let's get in front of legislators now with what ACIR is discussing and finding. And then, dedicate the subcommittee time to some of the other topics that we all know are out there. So John Felchak actually offered, he's not on our call today, so that actually makes it easy because he informally volunteered, and now that he's not here, he's now officially volunteered by virtue of the fact that he's not here to defend himself, to actually help consolidate that discussion about home rule, using Steve Mednick's summary as a baseline, and then touch on some of the different topics that we talked about, and even a couple of topics that we may not discuss formally in the subcommittee meeting, but we know has come up and is there's information available. And perhaps rededicate the LGF time, subcommittee time, to some of the other topics, which we can discuss at our full board meeting, commission meeting on Friday. I'm vamping a little bit from that by suggesting that, the one topic that I also think really drove this initially was the fact that a lot of folks, I think many of us felt that the term home rule was being misappropriated also in the context of zoning. And the societal impact that that has when people misunderstand and misappropriate the term home rule for the purposes of fighting or, you know, applying a certain perspective on how zoning should work in Connecticut. And while I just made that whole preface about where we could go as a subcommittee, I wonder if we could devote one more subcommittee meeting to that topic, which we haven't gotten to yet, which would be, you know, an October meeting. That's kind of at the core, it seems to me, of why we did this in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then begin talking about expanding that discussion beyond the October meeting. I don't know how folks may feel about that, if that makes sense to folks. I see a couple of thumbs up. Margaret?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay. All right. It's a lot of, you know, we are spending a lot of time and resource in there, you know, and I know Lon, you know, in terms of the presentation today, a lot of energy, you know, on developing the topics for these subcommittee meetings. There's one topic we do need, I think, to hit on. But then after that, maybe we can actually just do it internally among ourselves. Does that sound like a game plan? Lyle, how do you feel about that? Are you good with that? Okay. All right. Good. All right. Well, that's, I think, how we will proceed, if folks are okay with that. With that, I mean, we have a busy ACIR week this week, because this is one of those rare times where we'll have a subcommittee meeting and then also a full ACIR meeting in the same week. So we'll bring this up at the full ACIR meeting on Friday morning. Unless anyone has any other topics that we need to cover, Bruce, am I missing anything on our agenda that I should bring up?
I don't see anything, no.
Okay, great. All right. Well, Lon, again, thanks for pulling that together. I know you were making a lot of effort to try to get, you know, some other experts and folks to chime in, but you actually handled it all beautifully, I think, without having to have an invited guest instead.
And hopefully, yeah, and hopefully I got everything right. And if not, I will let you know what I got wrong.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for your time. And we'll see you all on Friday morning.
Okay, very good.